All right, what is inflammation? It's the body's response to injury. So what happens if you go out in the sun too long and you get a sunburn? What's your body's response? Inflammation. What happens if you get an infection? Inflammation. What happens if you stub your toe? Inflammation. What happens if you drink acid? Inflammation. What happens if you spill the acid on your foot? Inflammation. What happens if you hit your thumb with a hammer? Inflammation. What happens if you have a hangnail? Inflammation. What happens if you have a paper cut? Inflammation. So no matter what kind of injury, what's your body's response? Inflammation. So the inflammatory process has a couple purposes. One of them is to contain any damage, fight off any bad things that might be present, toxins or infection, and then repair the body so that it goes back to normal. Those are the purposes of inflammation. Now, there are four classic signs and symptoms of inflammation, and we need to know each symptom or sign, and we need to know what causes it and why it happens. It's like, what's the mechanism and what's the purpose? Now, before we move on, I keep using this word sign and symptom. What is the difference between a sign and a symptom? Wow, sounds like you guys have had health assessment. So, a sign is objective. It is something that can be observed by an outside person. A symptom is subjective. It is something a person feels. So, the very first one is erythema, which is a fancy way of saying redness. So erith is Latin or Greek for red. So erythema is going to be reddened skin. Now, what do you think is the mechanism of reddened skin? What in your body is red? Blood. Okay, so how do you make the skin redder? You vasodilate. So by vasodilating, that causes more blood flow to the area. Why do we want more blood flow to the area? More antibodies, more white blood cells. What does red blood carry with it? More oxygen. So there's more of everything you need to either fight or repair tissue in your blood. So we want to vasodilate, and the purpose is to get more blood flow to that damaged area. The second one is called heat. How many have ever seen someone who's had a really bad sunburn? If you put your hand over their skin, a couple inches away, what do you feel? Heat radiating off their skin. So that heat is caused by vasodilation, more blood to the area, and you get more blood. How many of you have cold hands, or you know someone with really cold hands? Why do they have cold hands? It's because they have a cold heart. But it's the vasoconstriction. There's less blood flow going through their fingers. If you ever known someone who's got warm hands, they have more blood flowing through their fingers. So the warmer something is, the more blood is going through it. So it's the same reason. So vasodilation and get more blood to the area. So what do those little ticks mean? Same as the thing above it. So every now and then students are like, what does that mean? So now the third symptom is pain. Now, let's talk about the purpose of pain first. What is the purpose of pain and inflammation? It's to tell you that something is wrong. Stop hurting yourself, go get help. Now, we will talk more about pain later on. It is not that simple, but for our purposes for right now, why do we get pain during inflammation? It's purposeful. It's a message. It's telling us, stop hurting yourself, go get help. Now, what's the mechanism of pain in this situation? How many have ever had a splinter in your finger? Now, under ordinary circumstances, you can go like this, and it wouldn't hurt at all, right? Or maybe a hangnail. You can go like that, it doesn't hurt at all. But after a hangnail, you go like that, and you're like, yeah, that hurts! Why does it hurt? Let's make it stop. Why does it hurt? And the answer is, you have sensitized pain receptors. The fancy word for a pain receptor is a nociceptor. Now again, the totality of pain is much more complicated, but this is in inflammation. The reason why we have more pain in inflammation is because of sensitized nociceptors. And that tells us, hey, something is wrong, maybe you should get some help. Any questions about any of these first three? Because those are the easy ones. This next one is a little bit harder. And it's edema, which is a fancy way of saying swelling. Now, before we can understand the purpose of edema, we have to understand the mechanism. And before we can understand the mechanism of edema, we have to understand why we don't edema in the first place. Now, how many of you are swollen up in edematous right now? Why not? I don't know. That's probably the answer for most people. I don't know. Well, that's a fine answer for now, but we're going to learn why. So, as it turns out, there are four physiological mechanisms that control the flow of fluid through tissues. And they prevent edema under ordinary circumstances. So the first thing that we're going to do is we are going to draw a little arteriole. What is an arteriole? It's the smallest artery that there is, just before you get to a capillary bed. And then on the other side of that capillary bed, we have the smallest vein that there is. And what's that called? A venule or a venule. And in between, what do you have? You have capillary bed. So that'll represent your capillaries, little capillary network. Now, what do you know about arteries? How are they different than veins? What? They have oxygenated blood. Okay, give me another example. Another difference. What? Thicker walls. Why do they have thicker walls?
They have
the pumping pressure of the heart. So the heart generates a pressure that puts pressure on the walls of the artery. As it turns out, the arteriole has about 37 millimeters of water pressure on it. So that's called hydrostatic. Our first pressure is called what? Hydrostatic. Now, on the arterial side, the thing that mostly generates the hydrostatic pressure is your heart. So, on the arterial side, the thing that generates that pressure is primarily your heart. Now, on the venous side, you've used up the heart pressure, so you don't have that. But you still have some pressure pushing out, because you've got fluid in the system. And over here, the major determinant of hydrostatic pressure is blood volume. Now, let's think about this for a moment. How many of you have ever owned or seen an aquarium? Now, what is the difference between a small aquarium and a large aquarium in terms of the glass? Thicker glass, the bigger it is. Why is that? Because the larger volume of water is heavier and there's more pressure. So the water is always trying to push through the walls of the aquarium. And the more water you have at the top, the more pressure there is at the bottom. So the more full your body is with fluid, the more pressure there is pushing outwards on the venous side. So on the venous side, you typically have around 17 millimeters pushing out. Okay, so you've got pressure pushing out over here, and you got pressure pushing out over here. Does that make sense? Now, There's also an osmotic pressure, which is a chemical pressure, that's pulling blood inwards. And that is generated by proteins. So we're going to call that plasma osmotic pressure. Now let me ask you this question. What is the major difference between the liquid that surrounds the cells in your blood and the liquid that surrounds the blood the cells outside of your blood? Does it have a different chemical composition, like different sodium, different potassium, or is it about the same? What's the water of your blood called, by the way? It's got a special word. Plasma. Say it like you mean it.
Plasma.
Plasma. All right. So, how is plasma different than the fluid in between your cells? It's got proteins in it. So there are plasma proteins. And what is the number one plasma protein? Albumin. So albumin plus the other ones collectively have about 25 millimeters of pressure pulling back in. Now, if you subtract 37 or 25 from 37, what's the net? -25 = 12. All right, so you have 12 pushing out, more or less on average over here. Does that make sense? Now, have you lost proteins through the capillary bed? So what's the osmotic pressure over here? It's the same. So 25 pulling in. So if you take 25 minus 17, what do you get? 12? No, it's not right. About 8. And that's 8 going back in. So from the arterial side, you're going to be pushing fluid out. On the venous side, you're pulling fluid back in. Not blood, just water. Does that make sense? So you're pushing water out, and then you're pulling it back in over here. Now, is there a difference between 12 and 8? Yeah, there's some left over. Somewhere between 2 to 4 millimeters of mercury, you're kind of left over. So over time, what do you think would happen? It would build up and you would swell up. But under ordinary circumstances, do you? No, you don't. So under ordinary circumstances, there's something else that's pulling fluid away from that area. What is that something else? The lymphatic system. So the lymphatic system is pulling away that excess fluid. So now let's think about this for a moment. We have three different mechanisms that can ordinarily together prevent swelling. But what happens if these things mess up? Could you have swelling? Now, the major thing that changes with hydrostatic pressure is usually you change this number over on the venous side. You increase it. Now, how could you increase venous pressure? Venous pressure. What? Okay, more blood volume is one. And give me another one. Crossing your legs? What? Huh? Really? Crossing your legs? What is it that pumps blood back to the heart from the venous side? Random muscle movements. You learned that, right? Right? You learned that? Yeah. Okay. What happens if a person's lying in bed all the time? Okay. So, we're saying what could cause a patient to swell under ordinary circumstances out of these three things? So the first one is, what if we muck with hydrostatic pressure? So in order to have this balance, you have to have a certain relationship of arterial to venous pressure. What happens if venous pressure goes up? So one way to increase venous pressure is if you block venous return. So what causes venous return in the first place? It's random muscle movements. So if you have a person who's confined to bed and doesn't move, they could have increased venous pressure. Another is if they cross their legs, what are they doing to the veins in their legs? They're smushing them, and that can cause decreased venous return as well. Another possibility is if you have a tumor that is pushing on the vein as well. That's another possibility. And then someone mentioned that we have potentially increased amount of fluid. So I'll just tell you. There's three conditions that can typically cause an increase in the total amount of fluid in the body. The first one is kidney failure. And that makes sense. What are the kidneys' jobs? Getting rid of water. So if you have kidney failure, what are the kidneys failing to do? Get rid of water. When you don't get rid of water, you retain water, swell up. Second one is heart failure. What's the heart's job? Pump blood. Now, if the heart isn't pumping enough blood to meet the body's demands, one of the ways the body interprets that is maybe the heart doesn't have enough blood to pump in the first place. Let's help by holding on to extra fluid. And so the patient will swell up because of that. And then the third one is liver failure. And that's a little bit more complicated. We'll talk more about it in PathoPharm 2. But the three major things that cause fluid overload are, number one, kidney failure. Number two, heart failure. And number three, liver failure. So if a patient is having swelling, especially in their legs, where does gravity pull water? Down to your legs. If they're having swelling in the legs, chances are it's a problem with hydrostatic pressure. So you need to check them for those three failures. You need to make sure their legs aren't crossed. You may need to make sure they're having enough movement, muscle movement. Does that make sense? When you go to the hospital, you guys are going to see nurses always telling patients, uncross your legs. Uncross your legs. You have no idea how just kind of natural it is, just cross your legs in bed. Uncross your legs. But I like it. But don't do it. Because in addition to causing edema, it can actually also cause blood clots, which is a whole other thing we'll talk about at the end of the course. So, hydrostatic pressure changes can cause edema. What are the two big causes of hydrostatic changes? Blockage of what? Veins. And two, the three failures, fluid overload. All right, what about plasma osmotic pressure? What is it that produces plasma osmotic pressure? Plasma proteins, and the number one is albumin. What's the number two? Immunoglobulins, also known as antibodies. And the third one, fibrinogen. So after that, everything else is less than 1%. So fibrinogen is about 7%. So it's like albumin is like around 45, and then immunoglobulins like around 40, and then fibrinogen is like 7%, and everything below that is like 1% or less. So if you know the top three, you know 99% of what you need to know. So what conditions could cause lower albumin or lower protein levels? Well, where do we get protein from anyway? From our diet? So we eat protein, our body chops it up into little... I don't know what our body does. We never had to take nutrition before. Amino acids. So you eat the protein, your body chops it up into amino acids, and then those amino acids are used in your body to make proteins. Does that sound familiar? Okay, so what if a person doesn't have enough protein in their diet? Right? So one potential cause of edema is not enough protein in the diet to make plasma proteins. Another potential cause is, well, maybe they're eating enough protein, but they can't digest it because they have some sort of digestive problem. like Crohn's disease or celiac disease. So those would be inflammatory bowel problems. Now, there's another potential reason why we might not be able to make the proteins. So you're getting enough protein in your diet, but the factory that makes the proteins ain't working right. What is the organ in charge of synthesizing albumin and most of the proteins in our body? It's a big one. What is it? The liver. Are you sure about that?
Yeah.
You seem more sure the first time than the second time. Yes, it's the liver. So if a person has liver disease, it's possible they might not be making enough albumin to maintain that osmotic pressure. Now, when a person has edema from decreased osmotic pressure, they tend to have swelling everywhere, not just in the legs. When it's fluid overload, where does it tend to go? To the legs, because of gravity. When it's because of decreased osmotic pressure, it tends to be everywhere. And then the last one is lymph drainage. Now, if a person has decreased lymph drainage, what is a potential cause? First of all, what causes lymph fluid to pump? I'm saying I can't hear you.
Oh, I said joint movements.
Okay, joint movements. So it's body movements are what cause lymph nodes to pump. So if a person is immobilized, they'll have decreased lymph drainage. If a person has decreased lymph nodes because they've had surgery, you know, like usually because of cancer, they could have decreased lymph nodes as well. So, for example, women who have mastectomy, they also typically take nearby lymph nodes, and they can have swelling on that side of their body. And then if a person has a tumor, and the tumor can impinge on the lymph vessel and cause edema that way. So those are potential causes of edema that muck with those three mechanisms. Does that make sense so far? Now, one other thing you need to think about is one-sided edema versus dual edema. If you have edema in one leg but not the other, is it most likely from a systemic problem or a local problem? Local. Would fluid overload be systemic or local? Systemic. So if a person has fluid overload or edema in one leg, sorry, erase that statement. If someone has edema in one leg only, is it because of fluid overload or something else? Something else. Does that make sense? So you need to think about it systemic versus local as well. All right. Dr. Heyman, this is inflammation. When are we going to talk about inflammation? All right. Now, in order for this little system to work, what had to happen from this side to this side? What had to happen to that number to that number?
Stayed the same.
It stayed the same. Why did it stay the same? What does it represent? What does the number that changes represent? Hydrostatic pressure. What does the number that stays the same represent? Plasma osmotic pressure. Why does it stay the same? You guys are going to kick yourselves when you find out how easy it is.
The blood still has the same.
Because you don't lose protein in the capillaries. So the protein levels are the same, arterial to venous. What happens if we punch holes in the capillary bed and we allow proteins to leak out? What would happen then? The osmotic pressure over here would be more or less the same, and now you've dropped your osmotic pressure down to, let's say, 10. And now you've got a whole bunch more fluid being retained up here. And that's what happens during inflammation. We call it an increase in capillary permeability. Sometimes you'll hear membrane permeability. Bility, can't spell. There's an I in there somewhere. You just can't see it. So, membrane permeability or capillary permeability. Your capillaries are made up of a single cell layer of cells called endothelial cells, and they are holding hands playing a game of Red Rover with the blood. How do you play Red Rover? You've never played Red Rover? Are you sure you were a child, or you like a test tube kid? Just like, you have no memory before age 18, do you? Yeah. So Red Rover is a game that kids used to play. It's called Children. So you all hold hands, and you have two teams. So one team says, Red Rover, send Cindy right over. And then Cindy on the other team has to run and try and break through the chain. And if they break the hands open, Cindy will get to choose which person she wants to bring back to her team. So the goal, the trick, is you have to break between people who are strong enough that one of them is worth bringing back to your team, but not so strong that you can't break. Because if you can't break it, then you have to stay on their team. Does that make sense? So, you're playing Red Rover with the blood. What does that mean? The endothelial cells are trying to bounce the blood back in. Does that make sense? What else are they bouncing back in? Proteins. But during inflammation, something tells them to stop holding hands, to let go. And that allows proteins to come through. That is the mechanism for edema in inflammation. So, the mechanism is increased capillary permeability. Now, what's the purpose? Why do we want those proteins to be out in the tissue? You don't know, do you? Do you? Okay. How would they help damage the tissue? Or help repair the damaged tissue? That's smaller than a protein. You don't need that. What's the number one protein? Albumin. What's the number two? Immunoglobulins, also known as antibody. Would it be helpful to have antibodies in the tissue? What was the number three? Would it be nice to have fibrinogen to help prevent the bacteria from getting into the blood? Some others that you might not be thinking about include complement cascade, which also helps to destroy invaders. So the purpose of edema is not to shift water into the tissue. It's to shift proteins into the tissue. And specifically, the proteins that fight off infections and help with repair. So now we have learned what inflammation is, the four signs and symptoms, the mechanism of each symptom or sign, and its purpose. And along the way, you had to learn the normal fluid physiology that prevents edema, which is the interaction of what four principles? Hydrostatic pressure, osmotic pressure, lymph drainage, and then the last one, capillary permeability. So, on your test, in addition to the inflammation stuff, you're also going to need to know non-inflammatory causes of edema. Does that make sense? Now, we were just talking at lunch with the faculty members about the difference between what is called a content-driven curriculum and a concept-driven curriculum. What's the difference, do you think? Am I teaching you more content-driven or more concept-driven? I'm teaching you concepts. Here's four separate concepts. We've illustrated, or we've defined what they are, then we've illustrated how they work, and then we've given you examples. Now, for your test, you could go the content route and just memorize each of those ones. Things that can cause edema. And memorize every single one, and then what mechanism it is, and then whether it's systemic or local. Or, you could try and understand the concepts so that when you're given any one of those, you can figure out which way it goes and what could happen as a result. Does that make sense? So when we think about plasma osmotic pressure, what causes it? Proteins. Proteins where? In the blood. Where do those proteins come from? The liver. Well, what if you had a problem with the liver? Well, it wouldn't be able to make as many. So if a person has low protein level or edema, you need to check their liver function. Where else do you get the proteins from? Well, from the diet. Well, we need to examine the patient's diet. Well, what if they're getting enough diet and they have a liver that works? Well, then what if they're not digesting correctly? So now look for inflammatory diseases. Does that make sense? So that would be more conceptual basis. You can get away with doing it content-driven memorization for a little while, but there comes a point where you can't memorize enough things and you get overwhelmed. So it's really important not just to memorize all the information, but to understand the concepts that underlie the information. Does that make sense? All right. At this time now, we're going to shift away from these first things to talk about some of the aspects of inflammation. Now, inflammation is kind of a complicated topic, and there's a lot of moving parts that all intertwine and interact with one another. So we're going to talk about some components first, and then we're going to kind of talk how they all fit together toward the end. And then we're going to introduce the immune system, and then everything gets wonky. So, some of the common elements of inflammation. Now, we talked about the vasodilation and heat. What is the purpose of the vasodilation and heat? To get more blood to the area. And one of the reasons we wanted more blood to that area is because we wanted to get white blood cells into that area. White blood cells can fight infections and they can also help with tissue repair. Now, imagine for a moment that you're driving along I-95 and you see a sign that says, this is where I'm supposed to get off. What do you have to do to get off I-95? You have to go to the side, right? You don't exit from the center. You have to get to the side. Now, what is the side of a page called? The margin. So the first step is a white blood cell must get to the margin of the blood vessel. And that is called margination. Sometimes you wonder, do they just make up these fancy words just to make themselves sound cool?
Well, the first step in the leukocyte's journey to the infection site is it marginates. Yeah.
Why can't they just say it gets to the side of the blood vessel? The blood vessel is I-95 in this situation. Okay, so the first thing is it has to marginate. Now, the next thing it wants to do is it wants to actually exit. So here's a couple things that help it exit. The first one is, how many of you have ever used a hose before? If you want the hose to shoot farther and go faster, what do? You stick your thumb over the edge, there's less surface area, so it shoots farther and goes faster, right? If you want the water to go slower, what do? You make it wider. How many of you have gone whitewater rafting? How do you make the river more fast and turbulent? Make it more narrow. How do you make it slower and calmer? Widen the river. So that same thing occurs. When you cause vasodilation, what has the artery done? It's gotten wider, and what happens to blood flow? It goes slower. So the white blood cells actually slow down as they get to the side. That gives them more chance to get out. Now, the white blood cell will begin to actually roll along the blood vessel. Now, what allows it to roll along in part is a change in the blood vessel itself. So the blood vessel begins to grow these little proteins that the white blood cell can stick to. And these are called VCAM. V for vascular. What does vascular mean? When you say cardiovascular system, what is vascular?
I don't know. I took AMP2, but I learned the word, but I don't know what it means.
Or are you just holding back on me? I just don't want to look stupid. Well, by not answering, it's too late. Because when you don't answer, I assume you just don't know it. What's vascular mean? It means vessel. All of we're having to do with vessels. You're like, I knew it! Well, no, you didn't. Or you would have said it. So I'm smarter than you are. No. You guys are crazy. You didn't say it loud enough. Yeah. One thing you should know, we haven't had this talk yet, is that I'm half deaf. So I put myself through nursing school in part by teaching dancing, dance lessons, Latin dancing, swing dancing, and when you go out to nightclubs that are entirely too loud, apparently what happens is you lose some of your hearing. So I can hear really well when the room is quiet, but when the room is not quiet, then I have no idea what you just said. I can hear that you said something, but what I hear is... And then you guys mumble on top of that, so you think you said, it's blood vessels. But what I heard was, So, when you want to answer a question, what do you have to do? Speak loudly and enunciate. Because otherwise, it's kind of like the opposite of the Charlie Brown, you know, or the teacher. What does a Charlie Brown teacher sound like? You've never seen a Charlie Brown cartoon? Do you know who Snoopy is? Okay, so Snoopy's owner's name is Charlie Brown. And if you've ever seen any of the Charlie Brown cartoons, all the adults in the cartoons sound like this. Wom, 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 wom. So when you think you're answering under your breath, what I'm hearing is wom, 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 wom. So there you go. Vascular. So vascular means blood vessel. So what is growing those little proteins? The blood vessel, the capillaries. So the little arterioles and capillaries are growing these little vascular cellular things, little proteins. So vascular, cellular, adhesion molecule. So it grows on the blood vessel and it adhesive sticks to cells. What cells in particular? White blood cells. So your white blood cell is holding on to these little handles that have been conveniently exposed or grown by the blood vessel. And that's going to allow it to slow down even further. And then, because the capillaries are beginning to start letting go, they're not holding hands as tightly anymore, it creates a little spot where when this little white blood cell gets to this spot, it swings on through that thing and squeezes through. Now, how are you going to squeeze that through that? What do you think? You gotta squish it through, right? So it's going to look like this. And then eventually the whole thing will squish through. Sound effects included. Does that make sense? Now, this is referred to as a pseudopod. A false foot. Pseudopod. So the process of creating a second foot is called diapedesis. I do not know who made this stuff up. Now it doesn't make any sense. This is a second foot. So the process is called making a second foot, diapedesis. Dia to ped foot. So the first thing that happens to get a white blood cell out of the blood into a tissue is we marginate, get to the side. Second, it'll start to roll along the blood vessel, sticking to the VCAMs, which are exposed only during inflammation. Then, it's going to swing through and squeeze out in a process known as diapedesis. All right, so that's what white blood cells do to get through. Now, the question is, how do the white blood cells know to go there in the first place? Not GPS. It's a good guess. It's actually their nose. How many of you have ever seen a Fruit Loops commercial? Follow your nose. It always knows. How many of you know someone with a really good nose? You're like, what's that? I can smell chocolate. And they find the person with the chocolate. Hey, can I have some chocolate? Yeah. So the closer you get to the source of a smell, what happens to the smell? Gets stronger, more intense. So that same process is happening on a white blood cell level. There are certain chemicals that act as attractants, and they call these chemoattractants. I know you didn't see that one coming. So it's kind of like perfume that attracts guys. Oh, you smell good. My roommates don't smell like that. Thank God. So, the white blood cells are attracted to that chemoattractant, and they follow it in a process known as chemotaxis. So you can think of it as the white blood cells ride chemotaxis to the site of inflammation. At least that's how I think of it anyway. But chemotaxis is the process whereby white blood cells follow those chemoattractants to the site of infection or inflammation. And the other fancy name for those chemoattractants is chemokines. So, during inflammation, one of the things that is released that causes and mediates inflammation are these little chemicals called chemokines that attract white blood cells to the area. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, why does a blood vessel grow those little VCAMs in the first place? Or express them? Well, yes, but what, that's the purpose. But why did it do it? How did it know? Okay, so there's other chemicals that are telling other cells to do stuff. And those are called cytokines. Yep. Yeah, you guys should do like a crossword puzzle or something with this. So a cytokine is a chemical that affects a cell. So cyto is Greek or Latin for cell. So it is a cell alterer, cell changer. There are dozens of cytokines in your body. We'll give you some examples as we go along because some of the drugs that we have target those cytokines. So for example, histamine is one of the cytokines that's released during inflammation. And histamine has a bunch of different things that it does. But one of the things it does is it causes vasodilation. What does that cause? Inflammatorily speaking. You got nothing? Swelling. No. Indirectly, yes, but not directly. Redness and heat. Okay. Then it also causes an increase in nociceptor sensitivity, which you would think would cause pain. But in fact, it causes itching. And then the third thing that it does is it causes an increase in vascular permeability, capillary permeability. What does that cause? That causes a swelling. So if we want to block the effects of histamine, what kind of drug would you take? An antihistamine. Does that make sense? So that's just to give you an example of one of the cytokines. There's dozens and dozens of cytokines, and some of them have very general effects, like histamine. Some have very specific effects, so they just do two or three things. So we'll be learning about some more of those as we go along. But in general, what drives the process of inflammation are chemokines, which attract white blood cells to the party, and then cytokines that change the behavior of cells. Vasodilate, clot, sensitize nociceptors, increase vascular membrane permeability, express VCAM. All those different things are driven by what type of chemical? A cytokine. All right. Okay, in the notes, what is your next slide? I have to see if we have enough time. we actually talk about different cells now. Okay, so the next thing we talk about is a whole bunch of different kinds of cells. So let's talk about some of the cells that are involved in inflammation. So first we have white blood cells. What's a fancy word for a white blood cell? A leukocyte. Leuk is Greek for white, cyte Greek for cell, white cell, or white blood cell. Now, not all white blood cells are directly associated with inflammation, and we'll talk about those later when we talk about immune system. So right now we're just going to talk about the ones that are inflammatory in nature. The first one is called a monocyte. Now, how many of you, monos is short for monocytes. So how many of you have heard of a macrophage? Sometimes you'll hear macrophages and monocytes are the same thing, but they're not really. What's the difference between them? Monocytes come before macrophages. What does that mean? Differentiate? What does that mean?
Specialize?
Change? Transform? Oh, that's the word I like. I can understand that word. Okay, so you're using all the right words. So differentiate means to mature into. Now, how many of you have brothers and sisters? And when you were quite young, say 3 years old, you all kind of had similar looking faces. But as you grew older, your faces changed and you began to look more different. You ever see that happen in families? So as they grew up, their faces differentiated into their adult form. Little boys and little girls, like 3 years old, or even younger, say a year and a half, sometimes you can't tell the difference, right? One of the most embarrassing things is, you know, you go, oh, he's such a lovely, such a cute little boy. She's a girl. That's one of the reasons why a lot of parents pierce their daughter's ears. It's the only way to tell people that it's a girl. Because the little girl looks like a boy. And then she grows up and doesn't look like a boy anymore. And then I remember my brother and I, my brother more so, he had this like curly blonde hair, and he also had blue eyes when he was a little kid, and we're like, oh, your girl's so pretty curly hair and those beautiful blue eyes. And now he's my 6'4" younger brother. Yeah. So that sometimes you can't tell the difference when something is very young. But as it grows and matures, you can tell that it changes and differentiates into the more mature thing. Does that make sense? Okay, so monocytes are immature macrophages. They have not yet differentiated into their final form. Another way to think of this is transformers. Now, I kick it old school when it comes to transformers because I watched the original cartoon back in the 1980s. And so it's the Transformers, more than meets the eye. That's the Transformers. This Michael Bay nonsense, that is not the Transformers. Each Transformer movie gets worse than the last one. Have you noticed that? Like, you can't even tell what the plot of the last Transformer movie was. You're like, I don't know. I have no idea. But what we do know is that when they want to travel from one place to another, what do? They become cars and jets and helicopters and stuff. And then when they get to wherever they're going, what do? They transform into a robot so they can fight. Right? So, a monocyte is the car. It's the Autobot. And it's using the blood as a highway to get to the site of infection. And when it gets to the site of infection, it's going to marginate. It's going to roll along the thing. It's going to diapedes. And it's going to then be in the tissue. At that point, it differentiates and matures into its final robot fighting form called a macrophage. Does that make sense? Oh, one thing I forgot to mention over here when we were squeezing that little white blood cell out, sometimes that process is called extravasation. So that is just a generic term to mean go out of the blood. And it can also be used when you have an IV fluid that leaks into the tissue. So what does IV mean? intravenous. So where is it supposed to go? In the vein. So if it's leaking and not going into the vein, but coming out of the vein into the tissue, that would be called extravasate, extravasation. Extra, outside, vasate, the vessel. So just so you know, that's another term that you might see sometimes used to describe the whole process. So when monocytes extravasate, they become macrophages. It's a one-way journey, though. Once you become macrophage, you don't go back and become a monocyte. Just like once you went through puberty, you couldn't go back and be a little kid anymore. How many of you mourned your little kid, your lost little kidness when you went through puberty? You're like, I don't want to be an adult. I want to be a little kid again. None of you want to be Peter Pan and the Lost Boys? No, I went full force. I had to get through puberty to get my driver's license, Dr. Heyman. You didn't understand. Nowadays, kids don't even drive. They just Uber. Whatever. So, monocytes become macrophages. Now, a couple things about macrophages. First thing is that we give them different names sometimes, depending on the tissue in which they live. So if the macrophage is living in the brain, we might call it a microglial cell. If it's living in your liver, we might call it a Kupffer cell. Did you ever hear those terms before? Yes, you did, in AMP2.
Can you spell that?
Kupffer? Named after Dr. Kupffer, who discovered them. If it's in your skin, you might call it Langerhans cells. Named after Dr. Langerhans, who discovered them. Yes, Langerhans. You've got longer hands than me. But Langerhans sounds much more fun. If it lives in connective tissue, you might call it a histiocyte. They're all macrophages that happen to live in that tissue.
Are these really important for
tests? They might be.
No, that's a yes.
Yeah. When girls say maybe, it means no. When men say maybe, it means yes. Maybe. So, we change the names of the macrophages sometimes depending on the tissue that it lives in. Now, macrophages have both destructive roles, where they destroy invaders and toxins, and they also have a regenerative or healing role as well. So in their destructive role, that's where they get their name, macrophage. What does macrophage mean? Macro means big, and phage means eat. So it's the big eater cell. And the reason is that they can eat hundreds of bacteria before they die. So the macrophage's job is to eat stuff that doesn't belong. Does that make sense? Now, sometimes whatever it is just too much or too big or too powerful for the macrophages to eat and overcome by themselves. And when that happens, just like the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, something special happens. Now, what happens when a Mighty Morphin Power Ranger can't overcome an enemy? I know you've seen the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. Come on, admit it. They join together into a giant robot. Oh, yeah. You see, you guys pretend like you don't know, but you know. So, what does a giant robot do? Well, it beats whatever the individual Mighty Morphin Power Rangers couldn't on their own, right? So, just like the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, your macrophages can join together into a giant cell that can beat things that a regular macrophage can't beat. And that giant robot is called a giant multinucleated cell. Why is it called a multinucleated cell? Well, because each macrophage has its own nucleus, and when you join them all together, it's got lots of nucleuses, nuclei. Now, what happens if even your giant multinucleated cell isn't enough to beat whatever it is? Now what do you do? What if you can't beat whatever it is you're trying to beat? It's a Skittle thing. Yeah. It's been there for like 20 minutes. Yeah. All right, so what happens if the giant multinucleated cell can't beat whatever it is? Do you just die? Well, yes. So what happens? So let's say that here's the monster, the bacteria or fungus that cannot be killed, kind of like Lord Voldemort. What we're going to do is we're going to surround the whole area with macrophages. We're going to ring the whole area so there's macrophages everywhere. So we're going to wall it off. Then we're going to put down scar tissue. What is scar tissue primarily made of? Collagen. So we're going to kind of like create a net. And then we're going to put other white cells, lymphocytes, around that. And the idea is if we can't destroy it, we will contain it. Banish it. And this is called a granuloma. So all of that goes on the destructive side of macrophages. We're not going to go into much detail about the regenerative side, except to say that it exists. So just know that macrophages will also be present in healing tissue, not just infected or damaged tissue for destructive purposes. Macrophages will also destroy your own damaged tissue to make way for the growth of new healed tissue. So you got to get rid of old tissue before you can regenerate new. Does that make sense? Okay. So that is pretty much the role of monocytes and macrophages. And it's about time to leave, so I think we have time to do one more. And that is going to be types of cells called granulocytes. Now, why do you think we call them granulocytes? What? They have granules. What is a granule? Yes, I mean, that is what it is. It's a little sack that holds something. But why do we call it a granule? Okay.
It looks like it is
under the microscope. Under the microscope, when you look at the white cell under a microscope, it doesn't look like much. In order to see the granules, what do you have to do? Stain them. So when you stain it, then you can see the granules. And those granules are little vesicles of chemical warfare destruction. So there are three types of granulocytes. The first ones are called neutrophils. These are the most numerous of your white blood cells. It's like about 60% of your white blood cells are neutrophils. And they are also phagocytic. What does phagocytic mean? Phage, eat, cytic, cell. So it's a cell eater, just like a macrophage. But in the case of a macrophage, which can eat hundreds of bacteria, neutrophils can only eat 1 to 2, and then they're dead. So your body uses them kind of like shock troops. It's the very first white blood cell to come to an area of inflammation, and they don't last very long. Pus is made up primarily of whatever the bacteria is, plus dead and dying neutrophils. If you've ever seen pus. Don't YouTube pus, okay? If you want to ever eat again. Anyway, neutrophils are the first to the party and the most numerous that we have. They typically attack bacteria, so you're going to see their numbers go up during bacterial infections. So high neutrophil levels are usually associated with bacterial infections. Now, in antibiotics, we talked briefly about bands, which are immature neutrophils. So a band is kind of like a teenage neutrophil. And what do teenagers do? They grow up and hopefully mature into adult. So in this case, adult neutrophils. So we can judge the severity of an infection by how many bands are present. If the number of bands is high, that means that your body is putting out immature neutrophils before they're really ready for battle. Does that make sense? So immature neutrophils are called bands, mature ones are called, well, neutrophils. They're sometimes also called segmented cells because when you stain them, they look like their little granules are segmented. Their nuclei look segmented. They're also sometimes called polys because their nuclei are segmented and weirdly shaped. So that's called polymorphonuclear. Poly, many, morpho, shape, nuclear, many-shaped nucleus, also known as polys. So if you're in the hospital and you hear someone say, the seg count was, what do they mean?
Neutrophils.
Mature neutrophils. And if you hear someone say, the poly count is, what do they mean? Mature neutrophils. Does that make sense? He's like, nope, got nothing. So it's just different names for neutrophils. Mature neutrophils are also called segs or segmented cells, and they're also called polys or polymorphonuclear cells. An immature, a teenage neutrophil is called a band. That's all you need to know as far as the different names go. Now, you do need to know what it means when bands are high. And what does it mean? The infection is more severe. All right. And what do these destroy? For the most part, bacteria. If you see high neutrophil count, that's probably bacterial infection. The next one is called eosinophils, or EOs for short. So these are not phagocytic. The only ones that are phagocytic in this little area are the neutrophils and the monocytes, or macrophages. Eosinophils are not phagocytic, and they primarily attack worms and parasites. So hookworms, pinworms, filariasis, all the weird stuff you get when you go on a mission trip to Africa or China. Eosinophils kill those. Eosinophils also kill parasites like malaria. Eosinophils are also highly associated with certain types of allergies. Asthma patients often have elevated eosinophil counts. So they tend to be associated with histamine-type reactions. And then the last granulocyte is called a basophil. And these are primarily against fungus. These are the lowest number of the white blood cells, like usually only about 1% of the white blood cells are basophils. Now, one of the things about these basophils and eosinophils is they don't just live in the blood. They also exit the blood and go into tissues. So we think that the eosinophil count and basophil count in tissues is often higher than what you see in the blood itself. All right, on that note, we are going to be done for today, and we'll pick up again sometime next week, and I'll let you know when that is.